Because the objection of the problem of evil requires that evil is something, either a real thing or the absence of good, as Augustine put it, but it has to be an objective condition of the world. The objection of evil has to do with evil out there, not just what we seem to personally define as evil. I mean, it's like saying, I can't believe in God. Why not? Brussels sprouts. I hate those disgusting things. Well, the fact is, I happen to agree with that. I think Brussels sprouts are disgusting, but I have a hard time understanding why my personal preference or lack of preference for Brussels sprouts, my personal distaste for Brussels sprouts, turns out to be an argument against the existence of God. Because it's like saying, I can't believe in a God who would create something that is unpleasant to my taste buds. But you see, that is the objection based on evil that a relativist is stuck with. Because they are saying, in a sense, that evil is really defined as something that is personally distasteful to my moral taste buds, as it were. That's all morality is, personal preference. And if all morality is personal preference, it's something inside the subject, as it were, it's not an objective feature of the world, then you can't complain about evil as an objective feature of the world as an argument against God. And so once again, you have a sibling rivalry. You have a condition, a belief that a person holds, on the one hand, that morals are relative, and then you have an objection that they have against the existence of God that is based on the idea that morals are not relative, that they are in fact objective. Well, they can't have it both ways. They've either got to bite the bullet and accept the existence of an objective morality, and at least then their objection to God based on evil makes a bit of sense. At least it's coherent. I still think it fails for the other reasons we talked about. But at least it's coherent. Or they must bite the bullet and acknowledge that morals are just to make me up, and therefore there is no such thing as evil in the world, nor is there such a thing as good. That good and evil are just personal moral preferences, and if that's the case, then you cannot object to the existence of God based on the existence of subjective personal preferences. Can't have it both ways. So that's the suicide tactic. More could be said about this. It can be employed very effectively in a number of situations. Look for the opportunities to employ it. And I've given you some illustrations. Let's go to another tactic. It's called taking the roof off. Now, this was a tactic that was a favorite of the late Dr. Francis Schaeffer. It is also a favorite of those who are fond of presuppositional apologetics, but if you're an evidentialist, I think you can use it well. And I think it's especially good with moral issues. Now, the idea of taking the roof off is very simple. You adopt the other person's viewpoint for the sake of argument, and then you show them where their point of view leads them. You adopt their point of view for the sake of argument, and then you show them where their point of view leads them. You see, this is a way of seeing whether that person can live in the world that they believe actually exists, moral or otherwise. Can they actually live by the statements that they're making? You get their rule of reality or their moral rule, and you simply apply it. This is also known as reductio ad absurdum. Had a person, a high school student, call me once on the air and said, my teacher is a relativist. She doesn't believe there is any right or wrong. How do I refute her? I said, steal her stereo. Now, the point is, obviously I didn't want him to actually steal it. I'm making a point that she has offered a point of view about morality that I suspect she cannot live with. Because the fact is, we all like to be relativists, but none of us want other people to be relativists towards us. We want everybody else to be objectivist when it comes to morality, and then we can live whatever way we want. I had a gentleman that approached me once at a Ligonier conference, and he made this statement to me. He said, I believe personally that abortion is immoral, but I don't think there should be any laws against it. Now, this point of view is called modified pro-choice. And it's seriously wanting. And you will see how bad a view it is in just a moment when I suggest to you the question you always ask anybody who makes this point. The question that you ask when somebody says that I think personally abortion is wrong, but I don't think it should be outlawed, and this is the favorite ploy of politicians, is you ask them, why do you think it's wrong? You think it's wrong? Why? Why do you think it's wrong? I mean, it's a very fair question. I've only had one exception to this answer. The answer that is given almost every time is this. Well, I think that abortion takes the life of an innocent human child. And that's why I personally think it's wrong. Now, what I did with this gentleman is I used the taking the roof off tactic. And all I did was feed back to him what I thought I heard him say. And so I said, let me just feed back what I thought I heard you say, and you tell me if I got it right or not. Because I'm a little confused about your point of view. Sounded to me like you said that you really believe that abortion kills an innocent human baby and mothers should be allowed to do that. He said, well, when you put it that way. I said, put it what way? That's your view. Now, if it's not your view, please correct me. But I think that's what you just said. Now, what did I do? All I did was take his point of view seriously and stated it back to him in very clear terms. Now, did I misunderstand? Maybe I did, but I gave him the opportunity to correct me. The problem is he couldn't correct me because that was his view. And he's shuffled from one foot to the other, and he scratched his head a little bit, and he said, well, and hemmed and hawed, and his wife and his daughter, adult daughter, were standing behind him going, yes, 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 you know. And I said to him, you know, I'm not going to let you off here. I'm not going to make this easy on you. It doesn't sound so good coming back at you, does it? But that's your view. The fact is, you believe that unborn children are human beings, and you also believe that women should be allowed to kill them. That's an example of taking the roof off. Frank Beckwith has a story he tells of his sister who was in a class once, and the teacher made the postmodern claim that there is no truth. Therefore, we ought to tolerate each person's belief. Frank's advice to his sister was that when the teacher said there is no truth, she should have jumped to her feet and said, class dismissed! Because after all, what's the point? Why are we sitting in class learning when there's nothing to learn? Some people are taking notes. What are you taking notes for? You think this is going to be on the test? What's to study? Personal opinions? Okay, I take the test. These are my personal opinions. I get an A because those are all my personal opinions. They're my truth. Why are we paying the professor? Don't we come to class to learn something? Professor says there's nothing to learn. Then what are you taking a paycheck for? You see, these are examples, taking the roof off. Oh, you really believe that? Let's take the view seriously then. Let's try to live in a world that you just described as the true world. The problem there, of course, is if that's the true world, then it can't be the case that there is no truth, because that statement itself is purported to be true, and now we're back to suicide again, as I mentioned earlier. But see, what Frank did was he simply took the statement at face value and he made application of it, but made application in such a way as to show how absurd the position was. I mentioned this is very good with moral issues. I was talking with an attorney once at a wedding. I was invited as a guest, and actually it was my date who was the friend of the bride, and I didn't know anybody there, and I was kind of bored, so I thought, well, getting a little chit-chat over the table with this female attorney, and somehow, and I wish I knew the details, but somehow we got into a conversation about homosexuality, and she immediately shot back across the table to me, well, as long as they're not hurting anybody, it's okay. Now, this is called the minimalist ethic, by the way. The minimal rule that it seems like in a pluralistic society we all can agree on. Now, my point of view is that the minimalist ethic is just too minimal. It does not capture what morality actually is. And therefore, if that's the case, then offering the minimalist ethic in defense of something like homosexuality is not itself going to be adequate. So I asked a question. I said, boy, I guess you were really upset about that dentist who was thrown in jail down in Florida. What dentist? Oh, that dentist that was molesting those women under sedation. No, I thought that was disgusting. What do you mean? Well, wait, oh, I misunderstood you then, because I thought you said that it was okay as long as they weren't hurting anybody, and those women didn't feel a thing. I guess you wouldn't mind if somebody was looking in the window watching you bathe, because that person is not hurting anyone. Now, I mentioned this to another person. That person said, well, they're invading my space. Oh, well, then we have more than one moral rule, don't we? As long as they're not hurting anybody, and as long as they're not invading my space. So we've got more than one moral rule that applies. Now, if there's more than one moral rule, I bet you there's a bunch of others out there, and it may be that some of the other ones out there that one could make an argument for might relate to the issue of homosexuality. Therefore, it is not enough to simply dismiss homosexuality simply because it's not hurting anyone. And by the way, even if that were the measure, I think I could make a case for homosexuality being immoral. You could ask the question of a homosexual who offers this point, how did your parents feel about your homosexuality? Well, they were destroyed at first. Now they've come to accept it. Oh, so it hurt them. It hurt them. Is that right? Is that what you're telling me? It hurt your parents. Because if it hurt your parents, then by your rule, your homosexuality was immoral. Of course, now they're going to want to start equivocating. Well, yeah, but I still have my rights. Well, okay, well, that you may be able to make a case on that basis. But the point is that your minimalist ethic is too minimal. It's not enough. This is a much more complicated issue than simply saying, as long as it's not hurting anybody. And by the way, we have an AIDS problem. I don't know if we have an AIDS crisis or if we have an AIDS epidemic, but we certainly have an AIDS problem in this country. And we have an AIDS problem principally because of two behaviors that private individuals do in private: intravenous drug use and homosexuality. And if there wasn't any intravenous drug use, and if there wasn't any homosexuality, then there wouldn't be any AIDS problem in this country. A problem that influences a whole bunch of people who do not use drugs and who do not participate in homosexual behavior. Point being, this private sexual behavior does hurt people. It's created a serious health problem in this country. So you can't simply just dismiss it as okay because it's not hurting anybody. It's a dangerous, dangerous way of living. And AIDS isn't the only problem. Values clarification is another example of this taking the roof off. The anecdote of a teacher in Newton, Massachusetts, who had attended numerous values clarification workshops in which the students are told to clarify their own values, and they give them moral problems or moral dilemmas, and they have to decide for themselves what they think is the right response. And of course, the goal of the teacher is to be totally neutral and not suggest what the students ought to do. Now, of course, this neutrality is misleading, because there is no neutrality. It's not neutral when you give children very difficult moral problems to solve and then say, it's up to you. That's not neutrality. That's moral relativism. And one of the problems, of course, is, and this is inevitably going to happen when you teach this kind of thing to sixth grade students, is they're going to clarify their values, and many of them will decide that in their value system, it's okay to cheat, which is what happened here. And so the students came up and announced that to the teacher. Now, what's the teacher going to do? Now, what they're doing, actually, is just simply following her instructions. They're taking the teaching seriously. They're applying what they've been taught. Now, the teacher's response was enigmatic, to say the least. She said, well, it's my class, and I value honesty. Therefore, all the students in my class should be honest. Now, does that follow? Is it a good reason, given values clarification teaching, that the students be honest because the teacher values honesty? Now, I would think that's a good reason for the teacher to be honest, but it wouldn't be a good reason for the students to be honest if they had different values. So at best, it's just confusing, teaching inconsistent. At worst, it's something akin to argumentum ad baculum, or persuasion from the barrel of a gun, to paraphrase Mao. I'm the teacher, I give the grades, you cheat, I'll flunk you. These are all examples of taking the roof off. And let me end with one, I think, rather poignant example from my own experience in the radio show. I had a call from a gentleman named Marty, who is a homosexual from Laguna Beach. And he asked me, quite frankly, what my opinion of homosexuality was. And I gave him my opinion without being unfriendly to him. And when I gave my opinion that homosexuality was immoral, he offered this justification. I almost said rationalization. Turns out to be a rationalization. But he thought it was a justification. And he said, I was born this way. It was part of my physical makeup. Ever since I was a young boy, as long as I can remember, I've always had this desire. And the desire is that anytime I get around other men, I have a sexual attraction to them. And therefore, how can you take exception, moral exception, with my homosexuality when it's natural? Now, that is a very popular argument. And it's a bad argument. And I demonstrated how bad it was by using the taking the roof off tactic. And I was very kind and gracious with this young man. But I said, Marty, how would you respond if I told you this, that I had an inclination personally? I don't believe this. But how would you respond if I said this to you? Now, he didn't hear the I don't believe this part. Unfortunately, it created some problems. But I said, my inclination would rise up in certain circumstances. I've had it all my life from the time I was born. I'm sure it's part of my physical makeup because I've never remember a time in which I didn't have this impulse. And it arises in certain circumstances. It naturally comes up, and then it's virtually uncontrollable. And the particular impulse that I'm talking about is that whenever I get around a homosexual, I want to beat him up. Now, he got very upset at that. And I said, Marty, I don't believe this. But what I'm asking you is, what would you say to me if I gave the rationale and justification for my gay bashing that I just did? How could you object morally? Because your point of view is that if it happens naturally, it must be amoral. It must be morally benign. Natural behavior is good behavior. And if this was natural for me, and I would suspect many men who are deeply offended by homosexuality might make that claim. Now, I think gay bashing is wrong. The reason is I don't believe that natural impulses are automatically morally benign. In fact, I think that part of being human is the ability to take moral stock of our natural inclinations and say no to them. That's what the moral life is. Animals always do what comes naturally, not human beings. And one could say that the difference between just doing what comes naturally and principled self-restraint is called civilization. And so any argument that it ought to be okay for me to do it if it comes naturally is really an argument for anarchy, an argument against civilization. What was interesting is we had conversation, further conversation on the issue, and he had abandoned that, and he brought up the minimalist ethic, and then I talked with him about that and took that away from him, as it were, and he tried a couple of other lame rationalizations for his behavior, and then he got very angry at me, said something really nasty, and hung up. Now, this was on a Sunday afternoon, as it turned out. You know, people were probably driving back from church and they heard this. So I had to instruct my audience. For those Christians out there that were saying, oh, my virgin Christian ears, first of all, you can't expect a non-Christian to live like a Christian. And secondly, I suspect that to God, this comment that this man just made, and it was pretty awful, probably wasn't any more offensive than the gossiping you were doing on the way to church that morning. So let's keep this in perspective. It's interesting, and this was the other thing I wanted to say to them, that what often happens when people have a commitment to a certain lifestyle that turns out to be evil, that they will try to rationalize the lifestyle, buttressing their activity with faux arguments that make their actions seem moral. But when you take those things away from them, they are left with their bare commitment to do what's wrong. In other words, they realize that what they really want to do is this activity, which turns out to be evil. And it doesn't matter whether they have a moral justification for it or not. But see, what happens is when you take this away from them, using the taking the roof off tactic, they sometimes get very angry then. And that's why Francis Schaeffer said you have to be careful with this, because this could drive someone to despair or to anger. What's interesting as a postscript is that Marty called me back about 3 weeks later, and Melinda let him through, and I wanted to talk to him. And what he said to me was that, you know, when we talked a couple of weeks ago, you almost had me convinced. Now, I was quite flattered to hear that, to be honest with you, because he seemed very rebellious to me at the time. He said, then I realized that what I really want is I want to be a homosexual. And I told Marty at that time, I said, Marty, I can't take you any further. You know what the real issue is. And it was so interesting that he made the comment after I had made my instructive comments to the audience after that phone call. Because he essentially was saying, you were spot on there. I just want to do what's wrong, is another way of putting it. Because he knew that his moral justifications were really just rationalizations. And this leads me to my next tactic, Rhodes Scholar. When spring rolls around and people's thoughts are focused on Easter, the newspapers usually run an article about the Jesus Seminar, who has sent out a press release that has essentially said there is no historical evidence for the resurrection of Jesus Christ. The articles read something like this: scholars say, or scholars agree, or the conclusion of scholars is, and then they give you whatever conclusion it happens to be. And this is where you want to employ what I call the Rhodes Scholar tactic. The Rhodes Scholar tactic is technically known as, or is at least kin to, the fallacy of expert witness. Just because a person is a scholar or an expert doesn't mean he's right. He might have credibility, but it doesn't mean his view is true. Now, how are you going to know whether his view is true or not? You see, the problem with these publications is they tell you what the scholars think. And so they inform you of their point of view. But they don't educate you about another aspect that's very important. You know what they think. You don't usually find out why they think that. And the Rhodes Scholar tactic simply is asking, why does the scholar say this is so? What is the scholar's evidence? You have an opportunity then, under that circumstance, to judge whether the thinking is good, or whether the thinking follows, or whether the facts seem to be good. And you might think, well, he's the scholar, he's the expert. Well, if he is the scholar and he is the expert, then he ought to be able to at least sketch out for you the path of thinking that allows him to come to certain conclusions. And then you can judge whether the thinking is good or not. And I use the Jesus Seminar as an example because they are a good illustration of a group that has very, very strong opinions. And they get a lot of publicity and a lot of press, and they're on an evangelistic crusade for their point of view. And because they have the label scholar, even though many of them actually are not scholars, they are taken seriously by the public. And so after these articles are run, you see letters to the editor to the effect that, why don't these Christians finally wake up and smell the century? Why don't they realize that scholars have disproven all of this falderah that they believe in? Because you see, these writers, these people who write into the letters to the editor, are under the mistaken notion that bona fide scholars have somehow uncovered new evidence that disproves Christianity, when that's not the case at all. When you ask the critical question, why do you believe there is no evidence for the resurrection? I'll tell you the answer of the Jesus Seminar. It's very simple. Resurrections don't happen. And if resurrections don't happen, there can't be any evidence for one, can there? You see, these people are naturalists. They believe in the cause and effect system that is closed to any intervention from God. there can be no miracles. And if there are no miracles, there certainly aren't miracles of resurrection. And it's interesting how they reason, given their presupposition that miracles don't happen, of course they're going to conclude that any testimony to a miracle like a resurrection must be false. And by the way, if miracles don't happen, then prophecy doesn't happen, because prophecy is foretelling the future, and that's a kind of a miracle. And so when you read in the Gospels the prophecy about the destruction of Jerusalem that we read, for example, in Matthew 24 or Luke 11, and we do know that Jerusalem was destroyed in 70 AD by Titus of Rome, well, guess what that tells us about when these books were written? Well, these books must have been written after 70 AD. So the Gospels are not early, they're late. And if they're late, guess what? They weren't written by eyewitnesses as they claimed to be, because the eyewitnesses were all gone principally by that time. And when the early church fathers bore testimony to the authority of the Gospels, well, then the early church fathers weren't people you could trust either, because we know these things were written late, not early, and not by eyewitnesses. Now, here's what you got to get out of this. According to the Jesus Seminar, Jesus did not rise from the dead. The Gospels were not written by eyewitnesses. The Gospels were written late in the first century, or maybe early in the second century, and the testimony of the church fathers cannot be trusted. These are not conclusions. These are presumptions that are made before one stitch of evidence is even looked at. Now, you're not going to get Time Magazine generally, or U.S. News and World Report, or certainly not the L.A. Times to tell you that. But it's vital to the validity of their conclusions. So, when someone says, well, scholars say, or the opinion of the academic elite is thus and so, your question ought to be, well, why do they believe that? Not just what do they believe, but why do they believe it? And you need not take their statements seriously unless they're willing to give you some good reason why you ought to adopt the same conclusions that they adopt. Rhodes Scholar. Why should I believe that opinion is the question you should always ask. Don't be shaken by high-minded pronouncements. Ask for reasons. Always demand an accounting of facts and reasoning. At least a preliminary accounting. And this leads me to my next tactic. And I call it just the facts, ma'am. Many people who attack Christianity are simply misinformed about the issues. How many times have you heard somebody say, for example, that religion is responsible for more bloodshed and wars and evil in the world than anything else? I mean, I've heard that dozens of times. Well, that's simply false. And the way you respond to that is to simply give the facts. Have them pick up a copy of the Guinness Book of World Records and look up greatest murderers. And what you're going to find under greatest murderers are people like Stalin and Lenin and Mao Zedong. And by the way, a Pol Pot and a Hitler and an Idi Amin are small potatoes compared to this unholy trinity. Because between them, they are responsible for the deaths of over 100 million people. And that's conservative. Now, these are people who were committed to atheism as a political ideology. And by the way, it just seems to make common sense that people who believe that a God exists to whom they must answer for their moral behavior are going to be more concerned about their moral behavior than those who believe that there is no God and there's no one to answer to. I mean, that just seems to me to go without saying. Now, it isn't to say that religious people cannot do evil. People who are bent on evil are going to find any pretense handy to justify their evil acts. But if any of you are uncertain about the impact of religion, let me just ask you a simple question. And this I got from Dennis Prager. If you were walking down a dark alley in South Central in the middle of the night and 10 young men were walking towards you, would you feel more comfortable if you knew that they had just come from a Bible study? The answer is, of course you would. Because though we understand that even religious people can do evil, we know at least there's something built in that would restrain evil in someone's life. If you have no restraints and no sense of accountability, well, there's nothing to check the evil resident in every human being. Just as a matter of fact, religion is not the thing that causes the greatest amount of evil in the world. As a matter of fact, it is the lack of religion that leads to the greatest amount of evil. When atheism is institutionalized, you have Holocaust. A few years back, I was listening to Larry King's show, and this is when Shirley MacLaine was in her heyday. She was on live on the program. During the interview, she mentioned that the Bible had been radically changed while being handed down through the ages. It had been translated and retranslated so many times that we have no way of knowing if our translation, what we have now, is actually accurate. And she acted as if this was common knowledge. And I know that you've heard this statement frequently. And Larry King in the background was just grunting his approval. Yeah, well, everybody knows that kind of thing. Well, that's another example of common knowledge that turns out to be common ignorance. Because it is not the case that the Bible has been translated and retranslated so many times that we couldn't possibly have any confidence that what we have today accurately reflects the original. Now, I don't have time to go into the whole analysis of how textual criticism works, also known as lower criticism. I've done that in some of the other teaching and done some writing on that. Suffice it to say that a whole discipline of literature is dedicated to this enterprise, reconstructing ancient documents based on what we now have existing. This is done, by the way, by non-Christian people. It's not a Christian enterprise. It's a literary enterprise. And the same rules that are applied to things like the Iliad and the Odyssey way back when, to even something as recent as Shakespeare, are also applied to the Bible. And when the rules of textual criticism are applied, it's been determined that the Bible is 99% pure, that it is not distorted by translating and retranslating down through time. In fact, we have over 5,000 portions of Greek manuscripts that we can use for comparison study. The Bible hasn't been changed. Yet there is this common notion. The Bible has been changed so many times. Another thing that comes up a lot is this claim that Jesus was in India during the missing 18 years of his life. This can be put to rest quite easily by appealing to the facts. What we do is we go back to the best historical records that we have of the person of Jesus Christ. And those best historical records written by the people that were closest to him are the Gospels. And the Gospels make it very clear that Jesus was nowhere but Israel during those so-called lost 18 years from the time he was 12, where we have the incident in the temple, to the time when he was approximately 30 years old and he started his public ministry. It says that he continued in subjection to his family and he grew in stature and favor with both God and man during that time. Now, nothing meaningful happened during that time. We have this summary statement. And when he began his public ministry, people were quite amazed, especially in his hometown, if you recall from the Matthew 4 passage. He goes to preach in the synagogue, and people are saying, who is this guy who got this great learning? Now, if he had been gone, they could say, my, you really learned a lot of interesting things in India, where you were studying as a guru. The fact is, their surprise was because he was a person who grew up in their midst. In fact, he said, isn't his brothers and sisters, this and that, and we know him. He's one of our own. He's just been a regular fellow. And now he's speaking like he knows a thing or two. When did this take place? It's clear from the comments there and from the other records that Jesus grew up in their midst. Further, there is no additional evidence that he lived anywhere else. I asked people, how do you know that he lived in India? I mean, look at his message, and I'll tell you what, his message wasn't Hinduism. It wasn't polytheism. He taught Judaism. He quoted all the time from the Hebrew Scriptures. He never quoted once from the Vedas. Where do you get this idea? Well, you can read about it in the Akashic Records. Oh, where are they? Well, you've got to have a channeler to get to them because they are floating around the universe. And somebody like Edgar Cayce can get at the Akashic Records. The problem is that Edgar Cayce got one reading from the Akashic Records about the life of Christ, and whoever wrote the Aquarian Gospel got a different reading, so you even got a contradiction there. Fact is, there is not one shred of documentary evidence that Jesus ever left Israel, except for the brief sojourn in Egypt that was recorded in the Gospels when he was an infant. All the rest of the time he was in Israel. Once again, just the facts, ma'am. There is a misconception about Christianity that is corrected by a simple appeal to the facts. Let me give you a couple of more very quickly here because we're running to the end of our time. I have just recently developed a new tactic. And what happened is I would listen to discussions on the radio about things that were of concern to Christians, moral issues to some degree. And I would hear people say things like, homophobe and racist, or they accuse Christians of being intolerant. And I was always frustrated because I never could quite get my finger on what exactly they meant by these things. Now, clearly it was a put down, and it was suspect immediately because oftentimes when certain types of people disagree with you, the first thing out of their mouth is a name. They call you a name. You think that racial preferences in, say, affirmative action are inappropriate, they call you a racist. You say that homosexuality is immoral, they call you a homophobe. You say that Christianity is the only way to God, they call you intolerant. And I was always frustrated by that because I think that there was an unfairness about that, but I couldn't quite get to it. And so I've been thinking about it, and I think I got a handle on it now. And I encourage you, when somebody uses a word like that, tosses it out, that you use what I've chosen to call the sticks and stones tactic. Sticks and stones can break my bones, but words will never hurt me. Well, that's not really true. Because words represent ideas, and ideas are powerful. And sometimes a good idea can be besmirched by somebody simply calling you a name. And if you don't know how to respond to it, you could be in big trouble. When anybody calls me a homophobe, I always ask them this question. What does that mean? What does that mean? Can you define that for me? And see, the key to this tactic is simply asking for a definition. What does that mean, homophobe? I'm confused. I thought it meant that homophobe, homo like self, phobe, fear. Well, it's not fear of self. Homo means probably refers to homosexual. Homosexual fear. A homophobe is somebody who's afraid of homosexuals. I mean, that's what I thought it meant, but that's, I think it's rather odd here because I'm not afraid of homosexuals. I just think that homosexuality is immoral. And you see, what a homophobe turns out to be is somebody that thinks homosexuality is immoral. But instead of dealing with the issue, people simply call you a name, and they imply that there's something wrong with you. You have an unreasonable fear. Now, Frank Beckwith has made great capital of this. In fact, in one debate, he said, you know, homophobe, now that's odd. What is a phobia? It's kind of like an irrational fear. I mean, people who have phobias are kind of sick, aren't they? They're fearful of things they ought not be afraid of. And so you're saying that I'm a little bit sick, I'm kind of unbalanced, and you're making fun of that. I mean, it's kind of like a handicap, like if I was in a wheelchair or something like that. Now, you wouldn't make fun of me if I was in a wheelchair, would you? And now you're making fun of me because I have this irrational fear. I mean, you're making fun of my handicap. You're more politically incorrect than I am. Now, Dr. Beckwith is pretty clever that way, and he can pull that kind of thing off. You don't have to be so quick on your feet as he happens to be. But I think it's fully fair to say, what does that mean? Why are you calling me a name? Why is it when I disagree with you, you call me a name? I'm confused about this. I had a person call me that on the air once. I said, you just call me a homophobe. I said, I didn't call you a fag or a fairy or a queer or a fruit. I don't believe in that kind of thing. I believe in having meaningful discussions about weighty moral issues, and that's what this show is about. Now, if you have a contribution to make, other than just name-calling, please make it. If all you want to do is call names, then please get off the air and we'll have somebody talk to me that really wants to have a meaningful discussion. Now that, by the way, is a very fair response. Because this is simply an ad hominem when people do this. An attack to the man. Nah, 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 nah. You're ugly. You know, you're stupid. Or something like that. Now that's an infantile response. It is not a substantive response. And sometimes when people come across ridiculing like that, making fun, which professors are very eager to do, by the way, of students, you say something like this. Ridicule is not an argument. Just because you've made fun of me doesn't mean that you've answered my question. Now, maybe all you're capable of doing is making fun and ridicule, and okay, well, that's all right. Well, now we know that. If you want to make a meaningful response, I'd be glad to hear that. This doesn't seem to me to serve any good purpose. Something like that seems to me to be entirely fair in the circumstance. You can get to that point by asking for the definition. Now, there's a movie out about Papua New Guinea and about a man who went there and visited there, and he came back with a story about this tribe, and he fabricated the whole thing, right? So in order to carry off this farce, this ruse, he's got to find people to dress up like natives, and he brings them over, and he pretends like, yeah, I brought them over to show you this tribe and everything. Now, apparently, there have been people who have taken offense at this because there are indigenous people, people of color, that are actually being played by Caucasians who have their skin colored. All right. I mean, this is part of the joke. It's part of the foil of the movie, you know, part of the ruse. But there has been objections that this is racist. Now, here's my question. What does the word racist mean? What does the word racist mean? It used to mean that you believed that one race had superiority over someone else. And not just that, but in a way that was relevant to the value of the individual. So you have one superior race, they had a superior capability. And because of that, those people were better than the inferior race. Now, that's classical racism. Now, that doesn't seem to be what's being depicted here. When a person believes that affirmative action is not a good thing, instead of addressing the issue itself, they're called racist. Well, what's a racist? I'm very interested in hearing a particular definition of that. Does that mean that you hate people of color if you're racist, that you're prejudiced against them? Racism and prejudice are two different words, by the way. They mean different things. I think there's a lot of confusion in the discussion about this issue simply because nobody has stopped in the discussion to say, what does the word mean? And I think if one stopped and defined the word, it would be much easier to have intelligent discussion. I'm not saying whether racial preferences are good or bad. I'm just saying that it's not appropriate to call somebody who disagrees with you a name that turns out to be rather meaningless in the discussion. And one way to get around that is to ask for a definition. Oh, you're intolerant. And what does that mean? I'm confused about that meaning. Tolerance used to mean that I have my view, you have your view, I think I'm right, you think you're right, we both argue for our point of view, but we agree to live together in social and civic harmony. By the way, the definition of tolerance requires that you disagree with a person. I ask someone, do you tolerate homosexuals? They say, of course I do. Oh, then you think homosexuality is immoral. I do not. Well, then you don't tolerate them. You agree with them. If you agree, there's nothing to tolerate. Tolerance, the word tolerance, is reserved for the respect that you show somebody who you think is wrong. That's what tolerance is. The word has been turned on its head, by the way. Tolerance nowadays is that you can't think you're right and somebody else is wrong. That's being intolerant. And there was a prayer that was offered on Capitol Hill in some kind of gathering where the Christian was asked to give a prayer, and I guess they rotate that prayer. And when the Christian gave his prayer, he ended with, in Jesus' name, amen. And when he said, in Jesus' name, amen, the place came unglued. People were angry at him because there were Jewish people in the group and there were atheists in the group. Of course, I don't know why the atheists would be objecting. They should have objected to the whole prayer, any kind of prayer. You are intolerant with that kind of remark. You're intolerant. Now, this is a very odd thing. You could well imagine the response, because it's very predictable in the climate today for someone to call that lack of tolerance. But think about what just happened. A Christian was asked to give a prayer. Wouldn't one expect the Christian to give a Christian prayer? When the Jewish person gets up, he should give a Jewish prayer. If the Buddhist person gets up, we wouldn't expect the Buddhist person, or the Jewish person for that matter, to pray in Jesus' name. He is going to pray in a way consistent with his own religious belief. He should not be expected to pray a prayer that makes everybody happy. You know why? Because that would be intolerant to the person that you've just asked to pray. Rather, what should happen is you ask a Buddhist person to pray. He gets up and gives a prayer that is consistent with his conscience. And guess what? Everybody sits there quietly, respectfully, tolerating his prayer. That's tolerance. It's all turned on its head now. Tolerance now is that you've got to think everybody's right. Now, of course, the problem with that is it falls prey to the suicide tactic. Because if tolerance is that everybody's view is correct, then why isn't my view that your view isn't correct also correct? Why wouldn't the exclusivist religious viewpoints be tolerated equally? But they're not, you see. And so tolerance just becomes a weapon, a passive-aggressive trick, as Dr. Beckwith puts it, the passive-aggressive tolerance trick. A weapon to enforce one political view. This new notion of tolerance and pluralism. How do you disrobe that? You simply use the sticks and stones tactic. You ask, what does the word mean? Let me give you one more tactic here that is not an offensive tactic, but a defensive tactic. It's a tactic that you defend against, not one that you use. And I call it the steamroller tactic. Because you're going to encounter people that are kind of like steamrollers. They talk real fast. They're very aggressive. They get in your stuff. They ask you questions and don't let you finish them. You start answering one question, they jump all over you. Steamrollers take advantage of the fact that it's a lot easier asking the hard questions than listening to the hard answers. The hard answers don't come as quickly as the hard questions, because many times there are issues that aren't resolved with a 30-second soundbite or 30 seconds of shallow reflection. Yet some people expect you to respond that way. And actually, the steamroller doesn't expect you to respond intelligently. He doesn't care about your response. He's just interested generally in steamrolling over you or just talking a lot, one of the two. You know, I meet two different types of people in this. Some people who are very interested in getting an answer, and other people who just want to talk. And generally, I don't take much time with the second. I attempt to stop a steamroller in process. And the way you stop a steamroller is you could walk away. I mean, you can just walk away. You say, well, you're not interested in having a discussion. Or I might say, you know, it's easier to ask the hard question than it is to listen to the hard answer. Doesn't sound to me like you want to listen to the answer because you keep interrupting. But frankly, I don't want to bother you with these ideas if you don't want to hear them. When I was in India that time in Madras, one of the people associated with the Hindustan Bible Institute who had had me come out to do the lectures had a friend who was a philosophy student and spoke English and was not a Christian. And so he wanted him to talk with me. Maybe I could talk some sense into him or something. But so we sat down at the table and we began to talk, introduced ourselves, shared some comments, and he lit off into this point of view. And so I listened for a while, and then I stopped for a moment and I began to answer, and he interrupted me, and then he kept going with more of his point of view. And so I said, okay. And he stopped then, and I tried to answer again, and then he was off again, and you know the type. And so I just sat there real quietly. I sat there, and he talked, and he talked, and he talked, and he talked, and then finally he was done talking. I let there be a silence there for a moment. And then I said, are you finished? He said, yes. I said, okay. And I got up and I walked out. Now, this mortified him and the gentleman who had brought his nephew in to talk with me. And they said, oh, please come back. Where are you going? I said, well, I thought that you wanted to have a conversation and have some questions answered. But it appears that you just want to talk. And so that's okay. If you just want to talk, that's fine with me. I just listened until you were done talking. And now you're done talking, and so there's nothing left to do. Now, what I did in that tactic is point out, as mildly as I could, I guess that wasn't exactly mild, but it wasn't harsh. It was direct. That if he wanted to learn anything from me, then he's going to have to listen. Now, if he doesn't want to learn anything from me, that's fine. I mean, I don't have the view that everybody's got to listen to me, but he shouldn't put on a pretense of wanting to listen and not listening. So you could walk away, or you could just simply stop him and say, wait a minute, you've got some hard questions. I'm interested in answering them, but are you interested in listening to the answer? If you are, then please let me finish my answer. And when I'm done, then if you have another question, then you can ask it. Is that fair? And you ask them, is it fair? Now, if it is fair to them, then they'll let you answer. But you see, you can't get an answer to one question if you get three sentences into it and he doesn't like what he's heard and he jumps on it and starts challenging you about what you've just said that takes you in another direction. And that just isn't the way intelligent conversations are carried out. Now, if you have a situation where a person is consistently steamrolling over you, just walk away. Don't waste your time. People say to me, well, Jesus said in Matthew chapter 7 that we shouldn't throw our pearls before swine. How do we know when we've gotten to that point? And I said, read what he says after that. Lest they take what is holy and trample it underfoot. If you're in a situation talking to someone, and you have a sense that what they're doing is taking the holy things that you have just said, and they are simply trampling it in the mud under their feet, well, don't waste any time. Walk away. Now, some people are going to, you know, give you a run for your money, and that's okay, but they are not going to be trampling you under their feet in the mud. And those are people I think it's worth spending some time with. But once a person starts doing that, that's time to say, you know, I don't think this is a productive conversation. And just graciously bid that person adieu. Now, I've given you a lot of different things to think about. You're not going to get this in one pass. I encourage you to go over the notes, listen to the tape over and over again. But most importantly, get a fix on what some of these tactics actually entail. And in just about every case, I've given you a one or two sentence description. And begin using them. The best way to learn anything is to begin doing it. Don't wait until you think you got it all down pat. I don't have it all down pat. And I've been doing this a long time. You learn by doing. Get out there and mix it up. Do the best you can. In the process, you're going to take some licks. But you're also going to give a few in a good way. You're going to have the opportunity for God to use what you've learned and to make some changes in people's lives. Don't get caught in the trap of trying to assess the effectiveness of your conversation by the immediate results. The harvest is always a season away. And sometimes with some people, it's a couple of seasons away. But it doesn't mean at all that the things that you've shared with them haven't sunk in and are not beginning to gnaw at them. And in spite of their response to you negatively, it may just be the case that you've put a substantial pebble in their shoe. And they'll be hobbling around on that for a while as the Holy Spirit uses it to bring that person more to the truth. But you will have been the faithful servant that took the time to study and learn and to practice in the heat of argument, in the difficult circumstances. You've put yourself at risk. You've had the confidence and the courage to stand up and be an ambassador for Jesus Christ. And I hope that when you do that, you do it in a winsome and attractive way. And in so doing, demonstrate that the Christian worldview is certainly worth thinking about. Thank you.
For more Stand to Reason tapes or resources, contact the store where you purchased this tape or call toll-free 1-800 the number 2, and the word reason. That's 1-800-273-2766.